This podcast is for people who are ready to heal body, mind, and spirit and are willing to take full responsibility for what that involves. I am not a doctor. I am not a therapist. This podcast contains adult language and themes that are not suitable for young children or those who are easily offended or triggered. The views discussed in this podcast are my own, based on personal experience and of those I have known and worked with for my entire adult life. This show is not meant to take the place of sound medical or mental health advice. You, and only you, are responsible for the choices you make based on the information you hear on this show. Welcome to the Alchemy of Natural Healing. I'm your host, Laurel Dewey. True healing is an alchemical process, meaning it must transform you on all levels, body, mind, and spirit. What affects one affects all three. True healing is one of the hardest journeys you'll ever travel, but it's one of the most rewarding and fulfilling when you get to meet yourself for the first time. If you're ready to take that journey, let's get started. Welcome to Episode 7. Today's topic is 8 questions you've never asked yourself. Originally, I was planning on doing 12 questions, but once I dove into my list, I realized I only had enough time to fit in 8. The inspiration for this episode came from my own healing and transformational experience. I'd be asked a question by an alternative doctor, a body worker, a trauma therapist, or a shamanic healer, and sometimes the questions were so powerful, I eagerly wrote them down. Sometimes those questions would lead me to create other questions that were byproducts of the original theme. I never was offended by the questions, insulted, shocked, triggered, or overwhelmed by them. But when I tested some of the questions I'm including in today's show on some people, I was surprised how many of them just stared back at me and looked shocked. I don't think they are shocking questions, but I'm also not afraid or intimidated to ask myself probing questions that make me think and ponder and hopefully generate awareness of the way I go about things or see where I'm getting in my own way. Over the last 7 years, I've jotted down a lot more than 8 questions, and so it took me a bit of time to go over all of them and choose the ones I thought were the deepest and required the most heartfelt thought from all of you. I think I'll do subsequent shows down the road like this one, where I choose another 8 questions and so on. If anything, I hope it gives you a chance to get a different perspective and forces you to re-examine your belief system. And if you are sick right now, gather the motivation needed to make real changes in your life. And if any of these questions make you extremely uncomfortable, incredibly exposed, full of boiling rage or brimming with suppressed emotion, look at that reaction, because that type of reaction often means that the question is hitting you so hard that it's ripping open an old wound that you want to keep covered. If any of these 8 questions make you feel so jacked up that you turn off the show, pay attention to that as well. None of these questions are malicious, rude, cruel, or spiteful. If you immediately begin to personalize them and in doing so, characterize them as mean or hurtful, that's all on you. Because my intention when I wrote down these questions over the last 7 years was always to ask myself the tough questions that would hopefully lead to less self-judgment and more ability to overcome lifelong obstacles, as well as a greater understanding of where I was deluding myself and just a way to keep myself honest. The questions I chose for this particular episode involve situations or mindsets that have to be released and resolved in order for you to move forward on your healing path. I understand that you won't be able to answer many of these questions right away, and don't answer them off the cuff. These questions will take you time to think about, so you can see the subject from all possible angles. There's usually a transcript generated for each of my episodes, so you can read the questions there or copy and paste them into a document so you can review them. And, you know, if you choose, write out your answers. If you're into journaling, that's not my thing. But if that's your thing, you could write one of the questions on top of a page and explore it as you desire. The first question is something I asked myself one day when I was being particularly hard on myself. And when I asked myself this question, it was the beginning of me choosing to not just keep doing the same things I always did in the same manner I always did them. And that question is, define what is enough, and when will you be able to do and be enough? I don't know how you'll feel when you dive into this one, but for me, it became like swimming through infinity, and every time I thought, there, maybe there it is enough, I'd realize, oh dear, it wasn't. The answer to this question will hopefully lead you to realize that the mere search for doing enough or being enough becomes exhausting to explore. You'll think you've reached the point where you can settle for whatever enough means to you, and then you realize that there is more that is necessary. Pay attention to how that search for doing or being enough makes you feel inside. Does it make you feel happy, peaceful, serene? Does it make you feel anxious, angry, or impatient? If your search to answer this question leaves you feeling anxious, angry, or impatient, see how that takes you out of your present moment and into a state of apprehension, disquiet, or unease. And see how that dis-ease around your state of being affects your body. When you attempt to answer what is doing enough, is your jaw tight? Are your shoulders tight? Do you feel a gripping in your stomach? Does your breathing become shallow? Does it put you on edge? Are you unconsciously shaking your foot in a nervous manner? Do you feel like you're being set up? If so, why? Do you define the concept of doing enough based on someone else's definition of doing enough? If so, why does this person have that amount of influence on you? Are you trying to meet their version of doing enough? If so, why are you agreeing to meet another person's definition of doing enough? You see what I mean about how the search for the answer goes into infinity, one rabbit hole after another with this first question. The word itself, enough, sounds like it has an end to it, right? That's enough. But when you ask yourself, that's enough for anything going on in your life, it's often difficult to determine the end point, especially when you're dealing with a health crisis. When I asked you to check in with yourself and see how this question made you feel, I mentioned the words unease and dis-ease, and dis-ease eventually creates disease. So if you are someone who hears themselves or others speaking about not doing enough, and you've heard this or felt it for years or decades, and the search of doing or being enough becomes impossible to establish an endpoint to, think about how your dis-ease around being or doing enough for all these years has created a grinding, unsatisfied sense of being inside you. And consider how that lack of satisfaction around never being or feeling or doing enough has contributed to how you feel inside and how you present yourself to the world. Question number two. Do you see your life as a battlefield? If you see your life as a battlefield, how much shrapnel are you willing to dig out of yourself before you wave the white flag of surrender? How many more wounds are you ready to suffer on your battlefield? And if you keep being wounded, how will you ever be able to completely heal? This battlefield belief system tends to turn a person into a constant fighter, battling everything and everyone they meet. Everyone is seen as the aggressor or the one who will eventually screw them over. So attack first and ask questions later becomes your MO. If you feel as if you have to suit up every day with virtual armor and weapons of destruction in the form of your caustic words and hyper-sarcasm, and You also believe that there is an envelope of a moment available in which you can actually heal whatever is unhealed within you. You are completely fooling yourself. I understand that when you are seriously ill or dealing with a long-term health condition, a certain amount of fight is considered important to rise up and overcome the issue. Well, take it from someone who has walked and fought on that battlefield and understand that it's not fight you need. What you need is focus, determination, clarity of purpose, flexibility, and certainly perspective. I played that battlefield game myself for about 1 year of my healing journey, and I've seen far, far too many people engage in this pointless battle mentality that takes them over and turns them into this out-of-control, insane at times individual that nobody wants to be around and nobody wants to help. You have to understand how you are appearing to others, especially healers, who have an understanding of what they are doing and how your fight club mentality is keeping you in a state of resistance, rage, totally in your head and not your heart, and infused with this myopic fixation on who did you wrong and who screwed you over and fight this and fight that. Just stop. Just stop. Okay? Stop believing you're in a war 24/7. That is the most insane way to approach your healing. Get off your merry-go-round of battling everyone and your disease. Fighting jacks up your resistance, and it generates inflexibility of the body and the mind, and you require the flexibility to navigate the healing process. I know that if you believe in this fight mentality, you're on the phone with your insurance company, battling them all the time. I know you're waging a war with the next person who tells you something you don't want to hear. I know that you believe the enemy is everywhere. Meanwhile, your stress hormone cortisol is so high at night, you can't sleep. And all you do is toss and turn and erupt in rage when you allow the mere thought to cross your mind of someone who's on your shit list. And let's face it, nobody sleeps on a battlefield unless you have one eye open, and that's not sleep, that's hypervigilance. Put down the weapons of your own destruction. Take off the armor that is protecting you from yourself. What you really need to do is find a room all by yourself and break down and cry and wail like you've never wailed before, because all of that fight you are doing is a front for the massive amount of emotional pain you have suppressed for your entire life. Once you get it all out, you will feel exhausted but clean, and you won't have any fight in you at that point. But that's okay, because what you need is patience with yourself, and that means pacing your progress and not beating yourself up if you don't meet your high standards or somebody else's high expectations for your progress. You absolutely need determination and a clear path forward, but that doesn't have to be infused with fight, fight, fight. You know, when you're in fight mode, there is no time for the necessary reflection that is required to do transformational healing work. Start a morning and evening meditation practice. Go for a walk every day without your phone. Spend 20, 30 minutes a day just sitting quietly and being present. Draw or paint a picture. Set up a large 1,000-piece puzzle and focus on that for half an hour daily. You'll find that when you take yourself out of fight mode and into introspective mode, you will be calmer and more able to make decisions about your healing journey that are far more productive and create greater outcomes. A third question. How many times a day are you focused on what you lack versus what you have? If all you do all day is focus on what you don't have instead of expressing gratitude for what you do have, you are not going to heal. I'm going to be doing an entire show just on gratitude, because it is that important an attribute to possess in order to heal. I know how it feels to have your health ripped away from you and to feel like you're getting the short end of the stick and how everyone else is having the time of their lives while you sit in a stew of illness and distress. Oh, God, do I know how that feels. And I know the pity party that often ensues from that reality. But I don't care if you can't move your arms and legs. You can be grateful for the bed you're lying in, the covers that keep you warm, the air you are breathing, and if you're lucky, the good people who are taking care of you. And if you can move your arms and legs, be grateful you can move your arms and legs and still be grateful for the bed you're lying in, the covers, the air you're breathing, and so on. Focus on every little thing in your day that made it a bit better. I don't care if it's the way the sunlight shone through your window and lit up an object on the bureau for 30 seconds that made it look really cool. Add that to your gratitude list. And every night when you're lying in bed, get comfortable and say out loud all the things that happened that day that you are grateful for. You can always start with, I'm grateful I'm still here, and go from there. If all you are used to doing is focusing on lack, you will have to force yourself at times to be grateful for the smallest things around you and express your gratefulness out loud to yourself. But if you are consistent with this exercise, once you start looking for the tiniest things to add to your daily gratitude list, the lack that you used to focus on falls into the shadows of your mind. I know this for a fact because I experienced it firsthand. And after years of continuing this nightly habit of expressing out loud my gratitude for whatever happened that day, I can tell you that I just don't see lack any longer. I realize I have an abundance of good and wonderful things to acknowledge every night, that anything in my life at that time that is stressful or not going as well as I'd hoped, it just doesn't occupy my every last thought as I drift off to sleep. It exists, but it doesn't override all the other things that I am eternally grateful for. Fourth question. Are you willing to lose something that means something to you if it means you will gain peace of mind and get your health back in its place? If losing it brings you peace and health, is it really a loss in the long run? Or is it only seen as a loss in the shock of the short term? I've experienced and witnessed plenty of examples for this one. Let's say you have a business that you started or inherited from your family and that has been financially successful and helps support you and those you love. But that business also has contributed to years, if not decades, of stress, emotional unrest, physical demands that have exhausted you, possibly to the point of creating serious health problems that you are now confronted with. And all you can think about is how much time you have left on this earth to enjoy life and how, if you didn't have the business, that could be possible. The only thing stopping you is perhaps the complexity of turning it over to someone else or selling it, and that may not be your best option. Another example is being in a relationship that was once good and healthy for you and your partner, but that has devolved over the years or decades into a highly dysfunctional and seriously unhealthy pattern of behavior, where all you can do is grit your teeth and avoid contact as much as possible. No matter how much counseling you've done on your own or with your partner has changed anything. In fact, it's often made it worse. When you truly reflect on the state of the relationship, you feel zero love, not even the hint of caring. All you know for certain is that you feel resentment and contempt on a daily basis. But you also know that to leave that relationship would create a high likelihood of disdain and rage from your children or your family. Just ruminating on the disdain and rage that would occur is enough to keep you stuck in a relationship that is dead and buried, and that you reanimate only when it's demanded of you. And you might lean on the excuse that you've put in X amount of years into the relationship, and that's reason enough to stick it out longer. It's as if the years of suffering are worn more as a badge that shows how you can take a punch and still keep getting back up. You see these years as something you have earned, and perhaps you don't want to lose because it would mean admitting you wasted precious years of your life in a pointless battle that is now making you sick. So in essence, in your mind, your investment in what you see as earned suffering eclipses the opportunity for peace and renewal that lie waiting for you in the unknown. There are any number of examples that reflect this theme of losing something in order to gain back your health. And the reason I included this question on the list is because it's a very common predicament that people on the path of personal transformation have to deal with. Too many times, the thing that is contributing to your illness, whether it's physical, mental, or emotional, is embedded in your daily environment, and often so intrinsically woven into your life to the point where it becomes the thing that has to be upended if you have any chance at experiencing healing and rebirth. Whether it's walking away from a job, a relationship, a hometown, a group, a cult, a club, a religious organization, or any long-held affiliation with something or someone that is very obviously creating dis-ease and disease within you. It will always be a major decision and create massive upheaval in your life. But inherent within transformation is death and rebirth. And both can be very painful experiences and require you to do things and make decisions where there will be a loss of something to gain what you desire. I've personally experienced this enough times in my life to know that the energy that instigates these life-changing decisions is always fueled by either self-preservation or a radical awakening that shakes you up so hard that you can't continue living the way that you've been living. The fifth question has to do with that sticky wicket known as forgiveness. This question involves making a list of the things or people in your life that you are not willing to forgive. Now, without having the burden of forgiveness attached to them, go down the list and ask yourself the question, am I willing to accept that this event occurred or this person did what they did to me and move on? If you cannot do that, ask yourself how much daily energy this event or this person is stealing from you and preventing you from healing, or just living life unencumbered by that mental presence in your head. You know, there's a lot of cute sayings in the personal transformation movement about forgiveness. Forgiveness is a gift you give yourself. Forgive, forget, and move on. Forgive others, not because they deserve forgiveness, but because you deserve peace. I heartily agree that the objectives here are increasing one's mental peace and being able to move on and not allow whatever happened to you to become your theme song. I want you to know that I completely understand that some of you will never be able to forgive what happened to you. And I'm not talking about someone not giving you a birthday present or ignoring you at a family dinner. If you can't let that shit go, there's another story altogether. I'm talking about vicious childhood abuse or violent abuse suffered in adulthood that is so egregious that it is the definition of unforgivable. I'm talking about next-level betrayal that leads to the destruction of not only your life, but the lives of those around you, those you love. I'm talking about events where the scars are either easy to see on your body or buried deep in your mind that haunt you. I get all of that in spades. But the bottom line here is how much do you want to heal yourself? That really is it. Do you really want that elusive peace you say you crave? Do you want to spend whatever life you have left focused on whatever brings you joy and contentment? You have to want all that and more than you want to maintain the focus on the event or the person who you can't forgive. And what I'm saying may come into conflict with your faith or just the belief that you have had drilled into you by your family, your friends, or society that tells you without forgiveness, you can't heal or move on. The problem here is that this mountain called forgiveness becomes a complicated obstacle in your life that becomes an eternal struggle where you can literally spend years fighting it and still not be able to forgive. So you feel like you're failing at this process. You feel like if I don't do this, I won't heal. You agree to shuck and jive and say, I'll forgive, but I won't forget. That's not forgiveness. I don't care what anyone says. If you don't forget, you're just playing at the forgiveness part. And what's the point of playing at this? You know, one of the first rules of hardcore transformational work is to stop bullshitting yourself. If you say, I'll forgive, but I won't forget, you're not forgiving. So don't even go there. Don't even bother. For me, it came back to that bottom line of self-preservation. What was going to make me able to heal and move forward in my life, in a life that I wanted to create for myself? In other words, I got to the point where all I cared about was my own well-being and whatever it took at that point to establish that well-being. I was all in. So I forgave what was easy to forgive, for me at least, and the things that were not in my mind forgivable, I accepted as either an event I had to experience for whatever reason or a person I had to encounter at a certain time in my life that was brought into my life for a purpose I may never understand until I have a conversation with God after I'm dead. And for me, and I hope for you too, removing the mental shackles of the belief that you can't heal if you don't forgive was a huge relief for me. And just inhabiting that understanding released me in this very unexpected way from the burden I was carrying at the time. Because as I said, and it can't be repeated enough, when you become exceptionally clear that your health and your well-being is all that matters, you are much more willing to want to craft your future without the burdens of all that shit that happened to you in your past. Your recovery becomes your top priority. You become much more important to you than the people or events that caused you massive pain. And there's a quote I found that says this beautifully. It's not attributed to anyone, unfortunately, but here it is. I will remember and recover, not forgive and forget. What I've been able to experience by doing everything I've mentioned here is that the events and the people who did unforgivable things tend to melt into the background of my mind the more I create and design a life that is meaningful and worth living. And isn't that the ultimate objective? And before I move on to the next question, let me just add that within the subject of forgiveness, the most important person you do have to forgive is yourself. And that's often the hardest thing to do. And I'm not speaking from a narcissistic point of view. If you're beating yourself up from things you did and you are seeking redemption for your sins, the best thing you can do is seek that redemption through the act of service to others. Onward to the sixth question. Are you willing to consider that the hardest, toughest, cruelest experiences in your life were given to you so you could gain the greatest wisdom and awareness? If so, would you give up that wisdom and awareness in exchange for never having to go through that cruel experience? And I will take it further. Think of something in your life that you saw as absolutely terrible, but that ended up creating or producing something that you love and cherish today. Would you be willing to go back in time and never have that terrible thing happen to you, while also being willing to give up that thing you love or cherish that was a result of it? If you are not willing to give up the thing you love and cherish, are you then willing to release whatever trauma may still be connected to the terrible experience? And by doing that, stop allowing that experience to be an emotional or mental burden for you? I can vouch for this one being one of the biggest mind screws, because a part of the ego is so deeply entrenched in whatever the horrible thing was. And then to understand that without that horrible thing happening, you would not have possibly the greatest or most treasured part of your life now. There's lots of examples that are all born from trauma. A woman who is raped and becomes pregnant and chooses to keep the child, and that child turns out to be the best thing that ever happened to her. Or the star football player who has every NFL team vying for him, and then he gets into a gruesome car accident, and in order to save his life, he has to have both of his legs amputated. And while he's in rehab learning how to walk with prosthetic legs, he meets the woman he will later marry. Your ego wants to hate or despise the event, but born from that is the greatest gift you couldn't live without. I've experienced this dynamic of trauma leading to wonderful outcomes that never would have been able to materialize in my life if it weren't for the traumatic event activating it. And this question is posed to you not just to be a mind screw, but to get you out of victim mode and to accept that sometimes, as Jack London wrote, the most beautiful stories always start with wreckage. The seventh question is this: what are the habits or traits in others that you absolutely hate or find exceptionally annoying? And the operative word and energy here is you have to be obsessed with these habits or traits you find personally unbearable. Write every single one down on a piece of paper. Now, how many of those traits do you secretly or overtly possess? I knew someone who demanded punctuality in others and had actual fits if someone was a minute late, but she was always late to every appointment. I knew someone who raged against greedy people, thought they were the worst people in the world, but who always made sure he had the biggest slice of pie or cake. I knew a minister who was exceedingly pious and had no problem calling out members of his congregation from the pulpit for what he called moral infractions, and was then convicted a few years later of financial fraud when he took the church's money and used it for his own personal enjoyment. As I said, the operative word or energy here is an obsessive or consistent hatred or strong objection to something that someone else does. If it's mild or occasional disgust, that's not relevant to the point of the question. Now, in order to ask yourself this question, you have to be willing to step back and check yourself as to whether the thing you detest is found within you. That's when your ego has to take a back seat, and you have to shift gears and examine your strong opinions about qualities in others and how they reflect back at you. When I did this exercise, and one of the things on my list was I really didn't like people who overshared about their personal lives and assumed I was interested in the minutiae of their struggles. And then I heard myself oversharing with several people I just met at a barbecue and realized, oh my God, I'm that person. And what that did for me was I stopped oversharing, and I had also more understanding of and less irritation at those who overshared with me. Interesting. The eighth and final question for today is, If you only ask questions of others that you already know the answer to, why is it important for you to engage in conversations that masquerade as interrogations? Does this make you feel smarter? Do you enjoy testing people to see if they meet the grade you've established? Do you do this because you feel more in control of the conversation? Are you striving to create a gotcha moment to catch them in a white lie or a full-blown lie? If so, how would you feel if someone did that to you? Turn the tables on your encounter and see it from the other side and now recognize what being put on the spot all the time feels like. And that shouldn't be difficult to envision because most likely that interrogative style you've adopted was done to you as a child. Maybe somebody told you that you should never ask a question you don't know the answer to. Maybe this person was a salesman, a policeman, or a realtor who needed to have the upper hand in all verbal transactions. The reason this question is on the list is because it gets you, if you're going to get involved in personal transformation work and approach it with the belief that you're a very clever person, you're just going to hear the resonance of your own internal dialogue. And you'll never be able to ask the right questions or hear the right answers to your problems. You will also never allow yourself to be humbled by what you don't know and understand that you don't know what you don't know. And that will prevent you from realizing any true transformational potential. That's all for this week. Thank you so much for choosing to listen to this show. If you like what you hear, share this podcast with others and follow me. Check out the notes for this episode where you'll see the links to find me on Instagram and X at Laurel Dewey or The Alchemy of Natural Healing. Looking forward to you joining me here next week when the topic is grow up, quit draining your energy, expect more from yourself, and stop the drama, mama. It's going to be sure to offend a few tender souls. New episodes drop every Saturday. Until then, remember that awareness is a demanding mistress. Once she wakes you up, she won't let you go back to sleep.